Hey there, partners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrant. Today's guest is the founder of several internet companies. He is Saul Orwell. But the one that he is most known for is Examine.com. Examine.com provides independent and in-depth information about various supplements out there. Saul, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Thank you for having me, man.
Saul, when I mentioned you in the intro, I said the one that you are most known for is Examine.com. And is that the one that you consider as the most successful of your companies?
So in terms of monetary, it's definitely not the most successful. But I think I reached a level where, you know, you go, okay, what is a company I would tell my friends about, mm-hmm. right? Or what's a company I'd want people to associate me with? So absolutely, in that case, examine.com it is. I mean, one of my favorite things is when friends tell me that their other friends tell them, hey, I found this amazing health website, it's called examine.com. Mm-hmm. And they get to say, oh yeah, you know, I already know the owner. So in terms of pride, absolutely examine.com is at the top.
Yeah. Which is the one which is the most profitable for you?
So in terms of profitable, way back in the day, I originally started off on online games, virtual currency in games like World of Warcraft or EverQuest. So that is when I made the most money back then. This is like 2003 or 2002. That's what was most profitable. But in terms of, again, in terms of a value of a brand or of a company that we could resell, then yeah, examine.com actually is still the most valuable.
Yeah, so some of the numbers that I saw about examine.com were really crazy. So what is the email list that you have for Examine right now?
So we actually heavily cull our email list, right? So everyone wants like a big email list. They want to say, oh, I got 100,000, 200,000, 50,000, whatever. So we delete emails if you haven't responded in 6 months. Uh-huh. So we've deleted, I think, alone maybe. I mean, our email list right now is maybe 170,000, but we've deleted about 150,000, 200,000 yeah. emails. So it's a very, because we've been around for 5.5 years, it's a very active process of, you know, we're still getting 500 emails a day, maybe up to 750 emails a day. Uh-huh. So it's not just about the number, I think. It's about how responsive is the yeah. audience to what you're sending.
So to build to this level in few short years, did you have to take a lot of funding to scale the company fast?
No, I mean, it's a common misconception that you need to take money to make it grow really fast, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we built something that people liked a lot. We get a lot of traffic. We get about 50, 60,000 visitors a day. And so that amount of traffic, it's not hard, right? 500 emails from 50,000 visitors a day is nothing, right? Yeah. It's just 1%. So it's not something you need to take money. You just need to build something that's so compelling that people can't resist but say, hey, friends, check this out. Hey, friends, check this out. We've never bought any advertising. Yeah. It's been purely based on word of mouth.
Yeah. So the reason I asked you the question is you are a believer in bootstrapping a company, right?
Yeah.
And not scaling it, or I shouldn't say not scaling it first, but what is the advantage of bootstrapping over taking funding and scaling a company fast? Because even for examine.com, you could have gone the funding route, and you mentioned yeah. in other interviews that you got many offers.
Right? Yeah.
So what do you lose by taking funding?
So I think people don't, you know, taking funding is very sexy these days, right? It's that you're going to take funding, you'll get a million, or you get 5 million, or you get 10 million, you'll grow the company, you'll do a C round or maybe a D round, you'll sell it for $50 million and you'll be super rich and super famous and you'll be in magazine covers and all that jazz. But the reality is that's not what happens, right? That's not what happens for almost everybody. And even my friends who have got 8-figure buyout, right? I got a friend who got, I think the company sold for $12 million. He worked on it for 4.5 years. But at the end of the day, he ended up getting, I think it was $600,000. Mm-hmm. And you may go, hey, man, $600,000 is a lot, but not really, right? That's just $150,000 a year.
Yeah.
If you start off as an engineer at Google or Facebook, you already had $125,000 a year, and you don't have to work nonstop, and you get benefits, and you get and all that other stuff, right? Yeah. So it's people see this amazing story about, you know, oh, Elon Musk did this and Peter Thiel did this. Sure. But they're not, you know, they're not the ones, they're not the norm. Yeah. They're the exceptional. And you may think that you're exceptional, that's fine. But at the end of the day, if you really kind of look at it and go, hey, you know, am I as driven as Elon Musk, right? Am I as smart as Peter Thiel or whoever? You know, or am I as like insane, let's say, as Steve Jobs? The answer for most people is they're not. Right. And so then the context, they have to go, okay, what am I trying to do? What am I trying to get out of this? So for me, especially as an immigrant, my thing was, you know, I just wanted to lead a comfortable life. And with taking VC money, let me do that? Absolutely not, right? Then you have to work 80-hour weeks. You have to work nonstop. You have to do this. You have to do that. So that's partly why I've always been like, you know, VC is fine. I'm not anti-VC as some people think I am. I'm more just like, you know, VC is a tool. And if that tool makes sense for you, absolutely use it. But for most people, man, like bootstrapping, it allows you the time to figure out what your business model is. It allows you time to grow and scale at a proper level, right? Like if you take investment money, you have to grow your company to 50 employees, 200 employees. That requires a lot of effort. If you ever hired, right, it's incredibly tiring. So when you factor all of it in, and really what it's about is, you know, what do you want to do? What do you want to get out of it? Bootstrapping is just absolutely it, hands down.
So now, being in the entrepreneurial circles, you know that your friend didn't get who sold his company for $6.5 million, didn't get that much. But now you know that. But I heard from your other interviews that you didn't take your money for even your gaming company back in 2003 when you were not in this entrepreneurial circles, right? So how did you know then? I'm curious to know that.
Well, I still knew what I wanted, right? I knew that I didn't need to have millions. I knew I didn't want to be famous, right? I knew I didn't need to be known or have $50 million in the bank. I knew all I needed was a bit of money so I could live comfortably, right? Again, it goes back to the immigrant mindset. I don't need an expensive house. I don't need a fancy watch or a fast car or anything like that. I just needed to be very comfortable, right?
It like was we logical look at, that
exactly, right? But we look at like what our relatives have, wherever they came from, where you came from, right? And it's like they'd be happy to make 1% of what I make today. Mm-hmm. So that's why it was really easy for me. And the other thing was, you know, at the end of the day, they take control, right? Well, the moment you take VC money from anyone, you lose control of your company. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm so independent, I legally changed my name, right? So the idea of having other people tell me what to do or what I can't do, that was a no-brainer for me.
So let's talk about your immigrant background. So where did you are originally born and how did you end up where you are now?
Right. So I'm ethnically Kashmiri, which is what, you know, Pakistan and India keep fighting over. Yeah. I was born in Pakistan, but we moved to Saudi Arabia when I was 2. Then between the ages of 7 and 9, I lived in Japan. Then back to Saudi Arabia. Then I did 8th grade when I was 14 in Houston. And then I did high school and university in Toronto. And then I basically retired. I lived in the States and Argentina for 5 years. And then 7 years ago, I moved back to Toronto. And I had been planning on moving to Panama. One of my best friends was living there. But then the recession hit and I finally decided, you know what, I'm too old. I don't need to be moving all the time. It's nice to have roots. So I did that digital nomad thing in the 2000s, but now like I'm proud to be a Torontonian.
Yeah. So your high school, so the first time you moved out of Saudi was to Houston in the U.S. at 14.
Yeah, I mean, I did grades 2 and 3 in Japan, but yeah, as more of an adultish, yeah, I did grade 8 in Houston, yeah.
What was it like to be in a foreign country at 14?
It was, there was a lot of culture shock, right? Yeah. So I was in Saudi Arabia before there was any internet. So just to give you a sense of censorship, if there's a Time magazine of, let's say, Hillary Clinton, they would take permanent marker and they would cover up her arms and her legs and anything like that. If anything is exposed, right, other than her face or wrists.
In the magazine.
Yeah, in the magazine. So TV like, was obviously...
This is Hillary Clinton you're saying. That means even a normal picture, nothing really...
Yeah, yeah, nothing at all sexual. They would just cover up any skin, right?
Wow.
So you... and then this is, again, this is pre-internet. So
I remember when I first landed in the US, I came to Penn State for my master's and I came from India, which is not that conservative at that time. And I was shocked by the skin that I saw.
Exactly. Right. And that's just one thing. I went from Saudi Arabia where I was at a very small like American school. And then I went to a Latino basically middle school in Houston. Right. So even stuff like the bus driver stopping the bus to yell at the students, that to me was crazy. I'm like, is this real life, right? So there was a lot of confusion, a lot of at times overwhelming.
Who was yelling
stuff
at the bus driver again? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
So the kids were fighting in the school bus, which never happened where I was from originally.
Oh, people were more disciplined in Saudi.
Oh, way more, right? And so she had to stop and yell at them. And we're in the middle of the road and cars are honking. And I'm just thinking, like, is this really happening, right? Or in class, right? Kids would just get up and leave. And I'm like, I can't even imagine getting up and doing anything, much as just leaving class, right? Or someone, I remember this very clearly, someone just lied down on the floor and like went to sleep. I was like, what the hell's going on? This makes no sense. So there was a lot of culture shock, a lot of like, you know, even slang, right? You don't know what the slang is. You don't know what people are saying. It's a little bit different. You know, even today, if you read a book and you go to school and they talk about something like fam or stuff like that, you have no idea what fam means, right? So you figure it out, obviously, but it was definitely a lot of culture shock.
I see. But you mentioned culture shock from your perspective, right? Did you have any trouble like fitting in or socially, or was it all fine?
So, yeah, no, I definitely had it. I mean, I used to be a lot heavier then. I used to be a lot more shy. So there was definitely a little bit of that. But, I mean, I was always, let's say, strong enough that there was no bullying going on. No one, like, went after me and tried to pick at me. I was definitely a nerdier kid. I was definitely a smarter kid. But I loved the NBA, right? I loved video games and all that kind of stuff. So I was still – I wasn't, like, the weirdo. So I never got any of that kind of bullying stuff. But definitely I was never one of the cool kids, or like I was there, I existed. No one was mean to me, but no one went out of their way to hang out with me, right? So, I mean, again, that's partly why I got into online games, right? Was all this culture shock. I didn't know what was going on, and online games were safe, right? You can be whoever you want. You can pretend to be whatever you want. So that's kind of, it's funny, right? This culture shock is what transitioned me into video games, which was transitioned me into entrepreneurship. So at the end of the day, right, it worked out kind of nicely.
Before we talk about your online gaming company, I'm curious to know, is this the time when you started reading George Orwell's philosophy?
No, so Orwell's came in definitely later in high school. I mean, I was always been very fascinated by politics and maneuvering and the machinations and all stuff like that. So I was always curious about it, but it was definitely in like grade 10 or 11 when Orwell's works kind of came more into the forefront.
For someone who is not familiar with this philosophy, what is the idea that he teaches, or that idea that caught you? Actually, I wanted to ask to summarize, but to summarize someone's philosophy in a few words is an injustice to their work. So I would ask you instead.
I'll say this, right? Most people associate Orwell with 1984, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea with 1984 is that the government looks into your window all the time. They're always spying on you, and they're controlling the information that you see. So I actually disagree with that as kind of reality. So a different book that took a different tact is Brave New World by Huxley. And Brave New World said was that instead of the government controlling information, there would be so much information that we wouldn't be able to discern what's important to what's not important. So on that context, I think Huxley is more important, right? We're more concerned about, let's say, Kim Kardashian being robbed than by whatever, let's say, you know, a corporation is doing or the government's doing, anything like that. Yeah. What really spoke to me from Orwell was more Animal Farm and the idea that one, like I'm not big on quotes, but that one famous quote about all animals are created equally, except some animals are more equal than others. And it really reminded me about this lip service that so many people give to, you know, individuals or human beings that we're all the same. Sure, we are all the same. But, you know, until last year, you know, Pakistan, for example, blocked YouTube. Right. You go to Turkey right now, and I think Google's blocked, YouTube is still blocked, everything's still blocked. Right. So sure, we're all the same, but the opportunity we're all afforded is not the same. Right. And the number one reason I've been successful is I was born to the right pair of milk chocolatey human beings that they ended up coming to Canada. Right. Like literally that is the biggest reason why I am successful. So that's what Animal Farm always taught me, was that, you know, sure, we're all equal, we have equal opportunities, but we don't have the equal ability to be able to embrace said opportunities.
So George Orwell's philosophy kind of spoke to your immigrant background in some ways, because extended family didn't have that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, again, right, just the reality that we all live in is not what someone else's reality is. And it's really important for us to take a step back, be self-aware, see what the other person's opportunities are, what they're not, what their motivations are. And oftentimes they don't really jive with what's available to you.
Where did you make your first $100?
That was definitely online gaming. So
how old were you at that time?
16, I think, maybe 17, 16.
High school?
Yeah, still in high school. So my original website was around QBasic, Quick Basic Programming Language.
Was it ogaming.com?
Ogaming came a little bit down the road. So Ogaming was a little bit more professional, a little bit more put together.
Okay.
But basically, we had this directory of online games, and we had ads on it. And I think we're making like $50 a month or something like that.
Yeah.
And this guy came to me and he said, hey, listen, you know, I want to buy ads. I'll offer you $300 for 2 months. And I was like, wow, for sure. And then he said, you know what, we'll do the CPA, cost per action. You know, we'll pay you per sale we make. And I'm like, oh, man, like I've tried this stuff before. He's going to see there's no sales. It's not going to work out. Mm-hmm. But instead, we actually end up making like $500 in the month or something. Right. So that was kind of where I originally made money, was I had traffic for online gaming. I hadn't figured out the right offer. Right. That was my lesson, that you have to know what your traffic is and what they'll buy. And so that was my original.
All that was there on the website is a directory of the games available out there.
Yeah, so let's say there was a page on EverQuest. So we were linking to interesting websites for EverQuest, right? So EverQuest has got classes and warriors and this and that. I don't even remember anymore. And items and stuff like that. So we were just linking to various websites, and people were using us as a way to find. Back in the day, right, directories were like Yahoo was originally a directory, right? That's all it was.
Yeah.
So back in those days, directories were quite powerful and useful. People liked visiting them. Mm-hmm. And so we got a decent amount of traffic.
As sons of immigrants' parents, right? The kids of immigrants' parents, I should say. We are often asked to become doctors or engineers.
Sure, or right. Lawyers.
Did you have any of that pressure as well?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my parents thought I'd become a doctor. I originally did want to become a doctor. I'm fascinated by human biology and surgery and stuff like that. And I decided I'd do an undergrad in computer engineering so that when I went into medicine, I'd have a more of an interesting background, right? Maybe even get into medical and robotics. So I actually went to university with a full scholarship, but you know, my mindset was never about that. Like I had it already. And there was one time in the end of my first semester, I had to make a decision. It's like, do I put my energy into my studies or do I put my energy into my business? And I chose business. So, you know, I lost the scholarship. My grades were terrible. There's no chance I would have got into med school anyway, but it gave me, you know, the kickstart into doing what I ended up doing.
So is this at this time when you're doing your undergrad in 2001 to 2005, you're talking about, is this when you started the online gaming company, the ogaming.com?
Yeah, so I'd already started OGaming a little bit before, but this is when it got serious, right? So when it's there's a difference between having something on the side, like a side hustle, and being serious about it, right? So it was around in university when I was like, okay, we have a real opportunity to do something really, really huge. And this is back when Google was starting to become the dominant one. This is when SEO was super easy, right? You just buy links and done. No one talks about this, but the reason TripAdvisor became so big was it wasn't their content was amazing or their website was amazing. Was TripAdvisor bought more links than anyone else in the
entire industry. What do you mean buying links? What is that?
So back in the day, the way Google worked was they said, okay, the more links you have to your website, that means the more important your website is. And so what TripAdvisor did, and what we did too on a much, much smaller scale, was they would go to other popular websites and say, hey, listen, I just want to buy links on the bottom of your website. No one's going to even see this. I'll pay you $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And they'd be like, sure. So TripAdvisor would buy links for stuff like, you know, New York hotels or Travel Toronto or Montreal Visit. We'd buy ads for like, you know, the virtual currency name, right? So in EverQuest, there was a currency called Platinum. So we'd buy a link for EverQuest Platinum. Done.
Okay, so basically your website will be on their, the link to your website will be on their website. It's
a
backlink.
Right. But it was a backlink. But it wasn't a big ad or anything. It was just in the side corner.
Got it.
To them, it was extra money, right? They weren't selling any ads. They were just selling links now.
Yeah.
And if you went to them and you said, hey, I'll pay you $500 a month or $1,000 a month, they were like, absolutely. And okay. So that's what TripAdvisor did really, really, really well, was they bought links to everybody's everywhere.
So you bought links for what? For ogaming.com?
Yeah, for OGaming and for other websites around that virtual currency world.
So what is the, before we go into this, I read from one of your other interviews that you sold a company in 1999. What was that?
I don't remember what company. I started up OGaming originally in 99. Maybe that's what the
Okay,
the
maybe I mistook that. So in 2001 to 5, you started one more business, right? Which was like modern day Yelp. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So actually, I tried quite a few. Some of them worked, some of them failed. But the big one was I got into local search right around, this is right around, I think, when Google Maps was first introduced, 2003, I think, or maybe 2004. And so, yeah, you know, I was living in a new neighborhood in Toronto. This is before there was any Yelp or any of the other ones. And I just went around and I indexed them all on foot. I indexed all these businesses on foot. And I put it online and it got very popular. And I was like, okay, you know what? I'll expand this to all of Toronto. So that's kind of how I got into it. We had badges before Foursquare was even an idea. We had badges. We had user rankings. We had reviews. We had recommendations. We had user submitted photographs and meta tags and stuff like that. So it was just something
so
I did.
Just go on foot to places and get their information, put it up on your own.
That's how we originally did it. Originally, we did it for the neighborhood, right? So we did 70 businesses like that. My dream is to still do that actually for Toronto one day is to, I think it'll cost maybe $1 million, is to set aside $1 million and be like, all right, we're going to index all of Toronto on foot. That will be the goal. But we ended up having to buy data, right? So you buy data from credit companies, from other data organizations. So it worked out pretty well, and people were submitting updates and whatnot. Yeah. But that's kind of how I got into local search.
So how did you build all these companies? Because it requires a significant amount of programming skill, business skill.
And so, I mean, I could program, right? So programming made it easy. At the end of the day, people overcomplicate their programming projects. They make it too elegant. They try to make a Ferrari when all you need is like a Nissan or a Corolla or something like that, right? So I kept it very simple. It worked out very fine. In terms of like, you know, business and whatnot, at the end of the day, we all crave responsibility, mm-hmm. right? So instead of micromanaging my employees or watching every little thing they do, it's like, okay, you know, you have your goal. We'll talk it once a week, once a month even. Just do your work. I don't even care if my employees outsource it to someone else. As long as the work is being done, who cares, mm-hmm. right? So too many entrepreneurs, they micromanage. They make it about their ego. Right. You look at any of my companies, you'll never see my name on it. You look at examine.com, I'm the seventh person listed on the about page. So there's a lot of ego involved. And I try very hard to be aware of said egoness and try to, you know, separate myself from that realm.
Yeah. So what sized company you had back in 2005 before you graduated? Like, were you working with all freelancers? Was it a team of people?
No. So just to keep it simple, like we did mostly go contractor, especially because they weren't in Canada. No one was in Canada except me. Mm-hmm. But I think at its peak, we had maybe like 30 people full time working for us across the gaming realm, across local search and whatnot. Yeah.
Right. So you graduated in 2005. What did you do after that?
So I realized that, you know, money wasn't what I was chasing, right? I didn't need to be super rich. I didn't need to be famous. So basically, I gave up the company to my number two. I said, listen, you run it. I'll pay you more than I pay myself. And then I just buggered off, right? So for 5 years, I was just in the U.S. I was all over the U.S., West Coast, East Coast, and then also in Argentina to explore South America. That was a lot of fun. But at the end of the day, to me, it was more just like, you know, I've reached a level of success that I'm happy with. I don't need to be chasing something hardcore that I think I need, which I don't really need. So that was kind of my mind shift.
Did you do the same thing for both companies?
Yeah, basically. So online gaming, we actually ended up partnering with another company because we weren't doing the inventory, right? The virtual currency product wasn't done by us. It was done by someone else. So we just teamed up with them to do it. Whereas local search, yeah, you know, you just put someone else in charge. You say, you know, you'll be the community manager or whatever else. You run it, and you know, and at the end of the day, right? Like I said, people crave responsibility. So if you say this is yours to run, this is for you to be famous off, this is for you, everyone to know that you are the boss. It does a lot for employee loyalty, especially with we'll get into it with examine.com, right? It does a lot for that.
Yeah. So what was the revenue that the local search was bringing that led you to
So honestly, again, it was online gaming made a lot more money, right? Okay. So local search made a decent chunk of change. I think the most money we made in one day in online gaming profit was like 58,000, 56,000. It was a decent chunk
of
change.
And what was the source of revenue?
It was virtual currency. So I've never ever sold anything physical. Uh-huh. Basically, you know, if you're playing a game like EverQuest, let's say you have to play for 50 hours and you'll get 1,000 gold. Right. But you're a busy professional. You're a lawyer, you're a doctor, engineer, because you're making your parents proud. So, you know, you only have like 3 hours a week to play. And you're like, I don't have the time to get 1,000 gold. Right. So instead you come to me and you go, hey, I'll pay you $500 if you give me 1,000 gold. And I'm like, sure. Mm-hmm. And then we would go to like players who were playing for too much. We got 10,000 gold. We were like, listen, we'll pay you $20 for your 10,000 gold. And they're like, wow, $20. Absolutely. Right. To them, it's like found money, whereas to the professional, it's like, you know what, I'll gladly pay the money, but they needed someone to trust. And that's kind of what we did for them.
I see. And did the games allow you to trade gold between people?
Yeah. So this was a bit of a gray area. The games didn't like it, but they couldn't ban it because legally it wasn't illegal. So you'd create like fake accounts. You'd create a middle account and you put the money in the middle account, and the middle account would be given access. The person who's buying it would get access to the middle account, and thus they'd be able to make the transaction. Eventually then games even introduced banks and whatnot. So it became super, super easy to transfer money and items.
Yeah. So you talked about the metrics that people focus on when they're starting out, right? A lot of people focus on unimportant metrics like number of employees or whatnot. Yeah. What were the metrics that you were focused on at that time for your online gaming company?
I think the most important metric at the end of the day is dollar per visitor. Mm-hmm. Right? The more you can increase dollar per visitor, the more you can market or buy ads or whatever, right? So number one metric is, you know, how much money am I making per visitor? It's not about the email list per se. It's not about the CPMs or any garbage like that. It's like, how much money will I make per visitor? After that, it's how do I get more traffic, right? The two get it to the two in line. So too many people become obsessed about, you know, I need to buy ads, or I have to build up email lists, or I have to do this, or I have to do that. At the end of the day, all we focus on is, are we getting more traffic than we were a month ago, a year ago? And are we making more money per visitor than we were a month ago or a year ago? That's all that matters, right? Mm-hmm. And as long as those two are, even if one of them is steady, but the other one's going up, like if you're getting more traffic, you're making more money, mm-hmm. right? If you're making more money per visitor, but your traffic's still the same, you're still making more money, right? Those are the only two things that really, and obviously like profit and loss and that kind of stuff, but those are the two KPIs that I think are the most important.
So when you retired in 2005, as you said, right, from 2005 to 2009, you were having a good time. You were traveling around in the US, in Argentina. And your online gaming company was making good revenue. You were probably able to do it for the rest of your life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I could have been a bum for however long I wanted. Absolutely.
And what made you not do that and decide to come back to the entrepreneurial world?
I mean, honestly, if I look back, I'm very aware of trying to learn things, trying to grow, trying to be more interesting. I would actually say those 5 years were a bit of a loss. I didn't really learn much. I didn't really grow as a person much. I mean, I every year I try to learn a new skill or two, and I really focus on it, right? And I feel like that didn't really happen in the context of those years. And so what actually happened was, I used to be a lot heavier, right? So I've lost about 60 pounds, and I was hanging out, and I'd already moved back to Toronto, and I was hanging out with some friends in Colombia. They're both postdocs. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, you know, like all the scientific research in nutrition, people are misrepresenting it. And they said, you're not doing anything with your life. Why don't you do something about it? Mm-hmm. Right? And you're like, well, shit, they kind of have a point. I can't really disagree with that. So that's kind of what the impetus was. And I realized, you know, again, that again, it's not about money, it's more about impact, right? So we know that we've cost supplement companies over, you know, $10 million a year in sales because mm-hmm. people are buying less glutamine or whatever because of what we say, right? So mm-hmm. it's been a very fascinating experience where money is not the prime motivator. It's more about what kind of impact can we do? What kind of a change can we do? So that's kind of what's been far more interesting to me, which is why I got into entrepreneurship or why I'm getting into pets. Again, it's not about the dollar, and I'm pragmatic about it. You need to make money to hire the best and have good employees. But it's more about, you know, what kind of awesome change or impact or difference can we make.
How was the transition like? I know for people who are working for a while and want to go back to school, find it hard to do because, you know, they lost their ability to learn new things. So how was the transition from, you know, just hanging out, traveling around, meeting people and having fun to actually sitting down and doing real work? What helped the transition?
I think it was actually pretty easy because at the end of the day, that's part of what drives my fun, right? So I know at this one cookie place that started the entire Cookie Life thing in Toronto, I've met over 200 entrepreneurs there, right? I love meeting people like me in a way that are driven, that are doing interesting things. So honestly, you know, there's two realms. You know, you could see the people who travel a lot and do it very cheaply, like couch surfing or hippies and whatever. Mm-hmm. And those are not necessarily my people. They're not as motivated. They're a little bit more, let's say, spiritual. And that's fine. If, you know, that's what drives them. But that's not my kind of person, right? So a really good friend of mine, for example, two really good friends of mine. I met them both through entrepreneurship, right? Mm-hmm. One of them did the 5-Minute Journal. He's also an Indian immigrant, came to Toronto when he was 17. You know, him and I, we get along really, really well. I would have never met him if it wasn't for entrepreneurship, right? Mm-hmm. My buddy makes another one, makes socks company, right? Him and I, we hang out all the time, would have never met him. So to me, it was more than anything else. I think, I wouldn't say I was depressed. I would never use that word for myself in this context. But I think I was just kind of aimless. Like there was nothing that was really inspiring me, nothing like that made me want to get up out of the bed every day and be like, oh, I'm going to kick ass. Whereas now every day I get up, I'm like, oh, I'm going to kick ass. I'm going to get emails from people who say I'm amazing. And I'm like, yes, you're right. You know, like obviously not too seriously, but it's a lot more interesting via entrepreneurship, via meeting interesting people because of entrepreneurship.
What kind of travel did you do? I'm curious. Now, you said that chilling out, relaxing kind of travel is not your type. what was your type? Were you like doing adventure sports, skiing, surfing all the time?
So I was definitely unhealthy, right? Or I was definitely a lot heavier. So even though we try, let's say, climbing a mountain here or, you know, going to like Iguazu, which are like waterfalls, but it's like it's pure nature. It wasn't as enjoyable. That's actually why I got fit in the first place, right? It wasn't about looking good or being attractive or dating or anything like that. It was like I used to do a lot of sports before, but it was like, oh, I can't do that stuff anymore. Right. So that was kind of the impetus where, again, it kind of ties into it, right? Like, what kind of people are you going to find that are more adventure related, but also have the money to go on more interesting adventures, right? Mm-hmm. So like 2 weeks ago, I was in Seattle with 11 other people and we did a rally race driving course. Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, that cost maybe, let's say, $3,000, but then you include the flight and all that stuff. It's a little bit more expensive, right? So it was with entrepreneurs that you find that have a level of adventure or that want to do interesting things, right? Like one of the guys there, for example, he drove a bike across Siberia, mm-hmm. right? And he drove an ambulance across like Mongolia, right? Like that's the kind of set where he's got the money, he's got that mindset, but he's also willing to do interesting things like that. So, yeah.
So you gained some weight and you were trying to figure out how the supplements work, and you were very active in Reddit trying to learn information and help out, give information that you have. And this is when the idea for examine.com stuck with you, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I've been on Reddit now for over 10 years. I've been on Reddit for a long time. I've been on it since it started, pretty much, mm-hmm. right before there was any subreddits. And as I was losing weight, I said, okay, you know what? I have an engineering mindset. I have a nerd mindset. Let's look into the actual science. And that's how I got into Reddit Fitness. So when I actually got into that area, there was, I think, 5,000 members in Reddit Fitness. Just to give you a sense of it now, there's 6.5 million members in Reddit Fitness now. Mm-hmm. So that's how I originally got into it. I started losing weight. I got a little bit healthier. The original thing, all I did was I just walked 10,000 steps a day. That's it. And so that's kind of what originally got me healthy. Yeah. And it was from that I bought all these supplements and I realized, hey, man, supplement companies are just ripping us off, right? This is absolute garbage. And that was the impetus to say, okay, you know, we've got an opportunity. People need to have a company that they can trust, right? A company that's not selling them nutrition, that's not selling them consulting, that's not selling supplements,
yeah.
right? That just says this is what's going on. And that's exactly how we got started.
So you were an online gaming guy till then, right? You were like the internet guy. Supplements were way out of anything that you have done till then. Was it scary to pick up like a new field? Oh, supplements. Now I'm going to be a supplement expert. Or was it like, oh, I can build one business, I can build more businesses?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, two things. One, I've never said I'm the expert. So I always find someone else to be the actual expert, right? Mm-hmm. So my co-founder, brilliant in supplement research. I have never written a single word on examine.com that's research-based because I'm not the researcher. So that's one thing. I was never scared because, hey, I wasn't the guy. The other side to me is always exciting. It's always super interesting saying, hey, you know, I've done well in online gaming. I've done well in local search, which has nothing to do with each other. How can I get into nutrition? Right? That makes no sense. And I was able to do it. So now then, like, for example, now it's like, how do I get into entrepreneurship? Right? I've only talked about entrepreneurship maybe a year, just like I think maybe 13 months. Mm-hmm. Yet my audience is blown up. Why? Because I have the experience, because I have the ability to say I've done this before, right? I'm going to get into the pet space. Pets has nothing to do with anything I've ever done before. But again, it's an interesting challenge going, you know, this keeps my life interesting, not, oh no, I'm scared. It's more like, okay, you know, this is exciting. This is something new. Can I do this again? Can I come out of nowhere and build up a huge company that everyone loves? I think that's the key part, right? It's not just be successful or have money, but can I build something that people really, really like talking about?
Got it. So you found your co-founder, who is the expert? I think it's Curtis, right? Through Reddit. He was the moderator of the community that you were active on as well. And you convinced him to not take a PhD and join you instead examine.com. So you put in a lot of work on Reddit, started getting organic traffic in different ways. What was the first, but it was still not profitable in the beginning, right? So what was the first thing you ever sold that made money on Examine?
So one of the nice things is because I already had money, there was no rush to sell anything. We could take our time. Mm-hmm. Right. Always you should take it as much time as you can. You should always take it, right, to figure out what the market really needs, what makes sense. So the first thing we sold was this huge reference. It was like 1,000 pages and basically said, you know, look up any supplement or look up any health goal and you can scroll to whatever letter you want and we'll tell you what works or what doesn't work. That was it. So I think it was originally just like $29. And my original target was, I think, 500. Mm-hmm. And I think in the first day we sold 1,200. I think we sold like 4,000 or 3,000, something like that in the first week alone. So that was kind of it. But it showed you, right? There was a pent-up demand. And some people even bought it saying, listen, you know what? I don't even care if it's good or not. I just want to support your company, mm-hmm. right? How many companies can say that people buy stuff just to say, I want to support your company? Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of stuff that got us going. That
how did you know? How did you know what to put in the digest that you're
so
going
to?
So
we always survey, right? Mm-hmm. We always survey. We always say, hey, listen, what do you need? What are you looking for? What can we help you with? When you sign up for our email list, right? The first email we send out, one of the questions we ask is, hey, or in our welcome email, we ask, what can we help you with? In like the sixth email, we say, hey, listen, we've sent you a lot of emails, but listen, what else can we help you with? That's it. So imagine that if we're asking 500 people that, every single day, we get a lot of feedback, right? Mm-hmm. So that's been very powerful for us. And not enough companies do this, is ask your users and ask them an open-ended questions. Don't ask specifically like, do you need A, B, or C? Say, what do you need help with? What's the problem? What do you wish you could solve? What do you wish there was a company for? What do you wish there was a product for? Solve their problems. And it becomes so much easier to make money.
Yeah. So you mentioned somewhere else also that you got many influencers in the fitness space to promote your digest.
Yeah.
How do you do that? You are not a well-known company at that time, right?
Yeah. So that definitely took time and it took years, right, to get us to the level of influence that other people would trust. But I think a big thing was we weren't competing with them. We weren't selling any consulting. We weren't selling any coaching. We weren't selling any training. We weren't selling any products. So they knew that if they refer people to us, that they weren't going to lose any customers. I think that's really important, right? People try entrepreneurs, they sell an entrepreneur product, but then they get other entrepreneurs to sell their entrepreneur product. But like, right, there's only so much money that people have to spend. Whereas in our case, because we were so separate and unique from anyone else, it made them look good. It made them look good to their audience saying, hey, here's a great website called examine.com. And people would comment and say, hey, you know what? I never knew about this website. Thank you for letting me know. So that was a big thing, was that since we didn't compete with them, it just made sense for them to promote us.
So in 2014, you already made like $500,000 in revenue through just this digest alone, I believe, right? I think we cut off for a second. Are you still with me, Saul?
Yeah, right here.
Yeah, about mid of 2014. Was this the time when you started thinking about replacing yourself in the company?
Yeah, so at the end of the day, my goal is always to replace myself. My goal is so we mentioned this a little bit, right? So Kamal now runs the company. So Kamal has a double MBA and PH. MPH is a master's in public health. It's like policy from Johns Hopkins. And then he was doing his PhD in nutrition when we picked him up.
When did he join you?
He joined us originally in 2000, I would say end of 13. Mm-hmm. But he became the boss like late 2014.
Now, I'm curious to know, what was the time when you actually started, okay, now that this is running well, this is a well-oiled machine, I need to replace myself. So when was that time?
But that's always true, right? Like at the end of the day, to me, I treat instead of having like, oh, VP of marketing, VP of sales or anything like that, I'm like, okay, we have a bunch of jobs to do. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is if I hire someone else and they can do one of the jobs I was doing, now I'm done, right? So if emailing the list was one of the jobs I used to do, and now Carolyn does it, who's a director of operations, I'm less involved, right? If another job was to edit Curtis's writing, that's another job less I need to do. If another one was figuring out what research we need to cover next, that's another job I don't need to do. So my viewpoint on that has always been like, the jobs that you need to do, can you get other people to do your jobs? And the less and less jobs you need to do, well, the less and less you're involved with.
Yeah, I'm more curious about the transition point, because when you started, you just started with you and Curtis, right? You didn't have Caroline, you didn't have Kamal.
Right.
So at what point you say, now Kamal needs to be the boss, now Caroline needs to do the email? So what is the transition time? How do you know?
Point, right? The point, the way I see it as, is okay, you know what, we're making X number of dollars. We can hire now somebody that would cost us Y number of dollars. Y is less than X, so that's good, right? So that we have positive cash flow. Okay, what are the jobs that Y can do that I am not very good at?
So it's more about making more revenue than what it takes to hire people. That is the inflection point.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't about, oh, now I'm done, or okay, now is the perfect time. No, it's like, can I hire somebody to do some more jobs for me? Yes, well, bring them in then.
So if you want to wait to replace, okay. So now I was going to ask you, one of the things that in my notes I had was, I was going to ask you, If you have to wait to make revenue to hire other people, why not just take funding? But you also mentioned earlier that you lose control in that case, which is not something that
exactly right. So absolutely, you can use, but again, it's also like the scale of what you want, right? Mm-hmm. So I mean, examine.com may be worth, let's say, $3-5 million today. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe in 2-3 years it'll be worth like $15 million, maybe, right? Mm-hmm. Funding, when you get funded, they're not looking for a $15 million company, right? They're looking for $50 million. They're looking for a $100 million company. So our scale was never like, if we wanted, we could rank supplements and we could sell supplements, right? If we wanted, we could do a lot of things to make more and more and more money, but that's antithetical to our actual idea, right? It's not our essence of being unbiased and being trusted. So absolutely, we could take funding. We could make $50 million a year. We could sell, oh man, if we sold supplements, we could easily make another $1 to $3 million a year, easily, with our eyes closed.
Sorry.
And not even sell supplements directly. We could just rate supplements and buy it from Amazon or buy it from whoever, right? The other few, bodybuilding.com, other few supplement companies, we make so much money, but then we wouldn't be the exact same company anymore.
And if you take funding, you'll be forced to do that because you have to grow as fast as you can.
Right. So even my friends who are in the investing world, who are in the startup world that I talk to, they're always like, dude, so you need to sell supplements. You need to certify supplement companies. And I'm like, no, like the moment I do that, we're not me anymore. We're not the company anymore. So that's why.
For another entrepreneur who is not used to, you know, replacing himself, right? People right. find it hard to lose control. I've talked to many entrepreneurs yeah. that they still do something very simple, like, you know, they're making $1 million, but they're just doing basic editing of their stuff, which they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
How does someone, what advice do you have for someone to be comfortable with letting go?
I mean, honestly, I think it's about checking your ego, mm-hmm. right? I mean, why do people make companies based on their name? Right? Why do they put their face all over their company and whatnot, right? Because there's a level of ego involved, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But if your goal is not to have to worry about the nitty-gritty, there's two things, right? One, you have to check your ego. And the second thing is it boggles my mind that people hire people and then don't trust the people they've hired to do their damn job, mm-hmm. right? So let's say I hire you to be my editor, and then every moment I'm like looking over your shoulder, I'm like, hey, what about this? What about that? Like, you're an idiot then. And by you, I mean me. If I don't even trust that I hired you, then I'm an idiot hire. Then I shouldn't have hired you in the first place, right? So when I hire people, I say, you know what, you can make a mistake once in one area, but you should never make that same mistake twice. And that's it. So, you know, Carolyn's made mistakes. She sent an email on the wrong day, or she sent an email to everybody instead of a bunch of people that she should have. That's fine. Like, it sucks. It's so annoying. You get frustrated. But listen, think about when you were learning, right? Think about all the mistakes you made. Like, I've done this for 17 years. The mistakes I made are ridiculous. Yes. You know, I had one of my websites, we deleted the entire database by mistake. And we were really, really, really lucky. I had just randomly done a dump for all the emails like a month before, so it didn't kill us. Otherwise, we would have lost 200,000 members, right? And I'm like, oh man, that is like literally the dumbest mistake I've ever made. No one's ever made a mistake that dumb.
Yeah.
And so no matter how many mistakes my employees make or whatever, I'll never be able to say that is the dumbest mistake I've seen, because I will always be the dumbest mistake that's ever happened, right? And I messed up the backups and all that kind of stuff. So at the end of the day, what always boggles my mind is, if you're hiring somebody, trust them to do the goddamn job. And most people don't. And that's where they're failing, where why did you hire them in the first place?
Yeah. So if the quality drops, it should be temporary. Exactly. And that is okay. If it's not temporary, you didn't do a good job at hiring, which is...
Exactly. Yeah. 100%, right? There's people... I mean, I think I'm a pretty good writer, but there's people who are way better writers than me. I think I'm a pretty good editor, or I can write for common people really well, but there's people who can do way better than me, right? I think I'm a decent UX, UI guy. People who can do it better than me. I'm a good programmer, definitely people who can do it better than me, right? So again, it may take them time to understand how we think, how we operate, but at the end of the day, it's so frustrating, but once it's done, it's amazing, right? Like, they send out a weekly email, the Research Digest comes out every month. I haven't read our Research Digest in over a year. I don't need to. They do a kick-ass job. So that's kind of where that stands.
When did you start... Or why did you, I should ask you, why did you start writing about entrepreneurship a year ago?
So basically, the story goes that, you know, I was at a music festival with my woman and some friends. And we're sitting on, you know, blankets and having a good time. And there's three kids in front of us. And they get up and they leave. And they leave their beer bottles behind. And normally, if I see people litter, I yell at them. Right? If I saw you littering on the street, I would actually yell at you. I don't care. That's just who I am. Unfortunately, I was a little bit too inebriated, so I couldn't get the words out of my mouth. And so I sat there like really angry. Like, I don't remember the last time I've been this angry. I was like, oh, these people are garbage. They suck. They're what's wrong with the world, blah, 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 right? All because of the three bottles. So then in comes this hippie dude, right? And he sits down and he looks at these beer bottles. And so this hippie dude's got like, you know, he's got no shoes on. He's disheveled, shaggy hair, shaggy beard, right? And he looks around and he sees these beer bottles. And I'm thinking, I have a new best friend. We're going to hang out afterwards. We're going to talk shit about these stupid kids. We're going to sing Kumbaya. We're going to dance over fire, all that jazz. But what does he do? He gets up, picks up the beer bottles, and throws them out. Mm-hmm. And then he has a great time. And I'm not one for, like, this was a big moment in my life or that was amazing. But, you know, I was very ashamed, right? We talk about the immigrant life and the immigrant dream. And one of my things is, you know, because I got lucky enough to come to the West, I have to embrace everything I can do. Right? I can't complain. I can't whine. It's not right. It's almost an insult to all my relatives because all my relatives are still back in Pakistan and India, right? They're all there. I have no family members here. And so the way it goes back to entrepreneurship is, you know, I used to make fun of these guys who do a $40,000 product launch. They're like, I'm going to teach you how to make money online. Or they get 2,000 visitors a day and they're like, I'm going to teach you how to get traffic to your website. And I just want to slap them like, you get 2,000, you should be ashamed. That's such a tiny number. We get that in 1 hour. Not even. We get it in less than an hour. Like, you should be so ashamed you only get 2,000. But how can I make fun of these people when I'm not doing anything to make a difference? Right? How can I make fun of them if now I'm not doing anything to say this is how you can do it better or this can be done like that? So that's kind of where the mind shifts, mindset shifted, saying, you know what? I've done this for a while. I don't need to make it about me. I no need to sell anything, right? Most people, they do a book or they do a mastermind or a group or event. I don't need to do any of that stuff. I'll do it because I enjoy it, because mm-hmm. it's fun. And it's been really, really fascinating, you know, getting emails every day from people saying, hey, you know what? I never thought about it this way. I really like this interview or this article you wrote because I know you're not trying to sell me something. It's been very, very gratifying that way.
But you did make it about yourself a little bit, right? Even the domain name is your...
No, so the domain I changed, right? So
it's sjo.com.
What's that?
Isn't it sjo.com?
Yeah, so originally it was on saulorwell.com, but I was like, I want a three-letter domain that's easy to remember. So that's why I bought SJO. It has nothing to do with my name, and eventually the idea is I will pay other people who are excellent writers to write me good in-depth articles on sjo.com, to write good case studies, to write good analysis. So it is absolutely a little bit driven by me, but it's more of a necessity than anything else.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you won't go to some random business website and be like, okay, I should trust them. I have to say, listen, I have made over 8 figures online. I've done this before. I have had employees. I've done HR. I've done legal. I've done entrepreneurship. So yeah. To a certain level, I do need to make it about myself,
yeah.
But that's why it's on SJO and not on Saul Orwell, right? That's what I've really, and that's why I say, you know, join the family, not become a follower or something like that. I want to make it more than just, oh, look how amazing I am, and more about, you know, what can we learn from each other?
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you mean. I recently read Ryan Holiday's Ego is the Enemy, and I totally associate with the ideas that you talk about being, making it less about your ego. But ego also sells, right?
Yeah.
So ego, if you put yourself out there, even though you don't, you're not doing it to pump your ego, but other people would respect the act more, or you'd get more traffic for it more.
I mean, yesterday I had a conversation with somebody about saying, hey, do you ever do any charities with your audience or whatever? And I'm like, well, the way I view an audience is, you know, I follow, like, I know Ryan, right? Like, when his books are back here, there, you know, I follow someone like, let's say, like Ryan or Tim or Ramit, right? I follow them, but I don't follow them necessarily to learn. I want to learn kind of what they're thinking. I want to learn what's going on in their head. I want to learn what their experience dictates to them, because they have copious amounts of experience, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was saying, like, that's the same thing with my own audience. I'm not trying to sell you something. I'm trying to say, this is a thought I had. This is what I think about it, but I love to hear your extension of my thoughts, right? So I recently wrote about how this is my morning habit and this is why I do it. And people responded with some really interesting articles about, like, what about this? Or have you thought about this? Or maybe this is why it works for you. Maybe this is why it doesn't work for you, right? So it's more just not just about, look at me from my bully pulpit saying, look how smart I am and brilliant I am. I'm going to teach you everything I can. It's more like, this is what's going on in my head about entrepreneurship or life revolving around entrepreneurship. What are your experiences? And I think that's a bit of a different switch, but it requires my name on it, because you now realize you're having a conversation with me as a person, right? So me loving cookies or hating raisins or thinking flip-flops are disgusting, right? That's something that you can connect with on an individual basis. So you need to bring your name out there. But again, right, my next project is going to be Pet Space. My name's not on that either again.
Yeah, you don't need it, and you only do it when you need it and not because you want it.
Exactly.
So, is because of SJO.com, is it when you started putting yourself out there? Because I see way more interviews of you in the last 1 year.
Yeah, exactly. So SJO was like, okay, you know what? I've got my approach where I'm saying you don't need to make $1 million or $10 million. You don't need to work nonstop. You don't need to have social media even, right? I'm not even on Instagram. I'm not even on Snapchat, right? Yet somehow I've made a lot of money. So it's more like, you know what? I have an audience on Facebook for sure. But if I shut down Facebook tomorrow, I would still have an audience, right? My examine would still get a bunch of traffic. Well, gaming would still be getting traffic from way back when. So a lot of it to me is more just about, you know, it has to be based around my experience for sure, but more than just that.
So there are two sides to an entrepreneur, right? So one is you have to prove to other people that you are a player, right? To get more customers, clients or whatever. And then the second one is you actually put the time in being that a player in a new area or new, something that is a stretch goal for you, right? So how do you allocate between, you know, showing to others versus being in a different field?
I think, you know what, I think they're both kind of the same. You said being an A player, player, but instead I'll use the Steve Martin quote saying that you want to be so good they can't ignore you. Mm-hmm. And I think those two prove themselves, right? So examine.com, if you look at it straight up, before we ever sold anything, it was me, computer engineer, and my co-founder who had a degree in dietetics, which is what you use to become a registered dietitian. He didn't have a degree in research, he didn't have a PhD, but we did it so good that it didn't matter. Right, we didn't have to prove, like, we did steps obviously, right? We wrote for The Guardian and we've been quoted in magazines, and that's important for sure. Social proof, leveraging stuff like that. You know, again, Ryan talks about it in his Trust Me, I'm Lying book. But what it really was about is like, look at our work, look how amazing our work is. Is anyone even as good as our work? And you're welcome to disagree with us, you're welcome to say where we're wrong, but. And the reality is no one could say what we're wrong at, right? Mm-hmm. We always said, like, listen, if you're going to complain about it, tell us something you're complaining about. And almost no one ever had anything specific they could complain about. Or if you're saying we're cherry picking studies, tell us which studies we haven't looked at or which studies we've looked at wrong. And no one could ever say anything. So I think honestly, the excellence in work feeds itself, right? Like, again, we didn't set out to make examine.com this big brand. We just did our work. And now people link to us. They talk about us. You know, I'm on Schwarzenegger's advisory board because our work was so good that his team noticed it, and boom, that's how that ended up being, right? So I'm not fully sure if I agree that there, I mean, I do think there's multiple sides in different things, but I don't think there's necessarily two sides to it. I think your excellence can speak for itself. And what happens is most people think that excellence, they don't understand what excellence is. They think it means writing 10 articles a day or getting 1,000 visitors to your article or going viral. That's not excellence. Excellence is something that makes someone read it and go, wow, I want to learn more, or wow, I need to read more, or wow, I need to remember this website. That's what real excellence is.
What's your writing process and schedule?
So for SJO in itself, I don't write that much. A lot of it is I have a bunch of Evernotes where I have like random ideas that are going on in my head, and I just kind of build based off that. A lot of it is also actual stuff we do, right? So my last article was on thank you pages and how powerful thank you pages are. So we spent months testing it out on examine.com, figuring out what works and what doesn't work. So a lot of it is just more musings and meanderings, and that's kind of one of the reasons why I don't take money is I can write about anything I want and I can take as long as I want and no one can ever say, hey, when you're writing something new, because you know what? It's none of your business in a way. In terms of examine, it's very user driven. It's like, okay, what are the...
No, I was more curious about SJO, to be honest. For example, in the thank you page, you spend the whole day writing that article or is it just a few minutes?
No, so it's very piecemeal. The way I do it is I do a lot of research. First of all, I'll search on Google for thank you page optimization, whatever, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I will go to these pages and I will write notes on them. And then I will contact the guys who or the women who wrote the article saying, hey, I really enjoyed your article. Did you think about this or what about this? And then I'll after all my research is done, I'll write an outline. And then after my outline is done, I'll start filling in the outline. Because once you have the outline, it's super easy, right?
Yeah.
And I'll fill in the outline. And then once I've done the outline, I'll go back to my original notes and I'll be like, did I miss anything? Mm. Did I forget to mention anything here or there? Mm. And then based on all of that, I'll write the article. I'll throw in images. And then all the people I originally contacted, I'll contact them again. And I'll say, hey, listen, I wrote an article. I'm writing an article myself. Would you like me to show it to you when I'm ready? Mm-hmm. And so it's a great way to also network and build your relationships up, because instead of being someone like, hey, look at my article, you're like, hey, I read your article. I like this. These are my questions about it. Oh, and then months later or whatever, you go like, oh, by the way, I'm finally releasing an article on it. Would you like to read it? So that's kind of my writing process. It's very piecemeal.
I know we are at time here. Do you have a hard stop, or is it okay for me to ask you one last question?
No, we can go just a little bit more.
Okay. Yeah. So I know you have the whole website dedicated to entrepreneurship, but anything quick that you want to mention, any advice that you have for others who are starting out?
I think people overcomplicate it and they overthink it. If you look at examine.com today now, right, we go like, oh, we've been in BBC and this magazine and that magazine, and well, here's our search engine and here's this, and look how huge our team is, like 20, 30 people contribute. But if you look at when we started, it was just the ugliest, garbagiest looking website of all time, right? So people overcomplicate. They think they have to be this professional and put this much money in a video reel and this and this. Not really. All you need to do when you're starting off entrepreneurship is figure out something you can sell. It could be a service. It could be a product, coaching, consulting, whatever you want. And then figure out how to get people who want to buy that and sell it to them. And that's it. So like, you know, if like pet space, you know, and it's a bit different for me because I take the long road. But let's say I know I'm going to sell a book on ebook on training. Mm-hmm. And let's say I know I'm going to do it on dogs. Mm-hmm. All right. So my number one thing is I'm gonna be like, OK, I should write an article about not just training specifically. Right? I should write something about very, very specific kind of training. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll talk about like how to get your dog to use a pee pad. Right. And then I'll do the exact same thing. I'll research it. I'll contact people. I'll write an article, and I won't even have a beautiful website. Like pet.org originally is going to be some free theme you can buy and WordPress site done. Right. Mm-hmm. Contact these authors. I'll write about it and I'll email them being like, hey, we wrote an article about, you know, how to make your pet use your pee pad.
Yeah.
And then at the end, we'll be like, hey, you know, join our email list so that you get our next article on how to get your pets to not eat food all the time or whatever. Right. Some article like that. Yeah. Done. That's it. And you think about it and like, how is that a business? But that's how businesses start, right? We're solving a problem, which is information on pets. We have a product, sell training guide on pets, and we're getting traffic. Done. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah. Don't overcomplicate it. Solve someone's problem and try to make a quick progress.
Way, way overcomplicated. And not just overcomplicated. They think they need much more things. They need to make this huge corporation, or they need to get an LLC, and they need an accountant, and they need money, and they need to get a trademark. We didn't even get a trademark from examine.com like 2 years in. Mm-hmm. Done, right? They think they need all this stuff, but you don't. You just need to get started. And if you're making money, then you can worry about everything else.
We can definitely say hello to you on Twitter, I believe, which I'll link the Twitter handle in the show notes. But if you want to send you cookies, where can we do so?
I think the best thing would be to sign up at SJO.com, join the family, and then say hello. And then we don't even get into the cookie life and all that insanity, but we can then get into it from there.
Okay. SJO.com. I'll link to it, and you can join the subscriber link. You can subscribe to the email list there as well. Saul, this has been a blast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, man. It was a blast for myself too.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again, and have an amazing day.